Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello everybody, and a warm welcome to our first Motorsport Magazine podcast of 2015. And I must say, it is a real honour and a privilege to have back on our podcast Dario Franchitti. What better way to start the year? Dario, hi, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me. I was just around the corner, so I thought I'd come round and have a cup of tea.
Yeah, good. Well, carry on. Anyway, thank you everybody for joining us, and we've got a fantastic lineup this year. I'll tell you a bit more about that at the end. But with me today, of course, is our editor-in-chief, Nigel Roebuck, our roving man. Can I call you our roving man? Yes, I can. It's Simon Aaron, our editor himself. Looks very chippy today, I must say, our editor, Damien Smith. And we have, I don't know how many questions we have from you, our listeners, but there are a lot of them, and I'm going to start with one from Alan McNish.
Start at the bottom.
Start at the bottom and work upwards, yeah. Okay. We'll come to Formula E in a minute, by the way. Mr. McNish seems rather concerned. He wants to know where his $10 are, Dario.
That's funny. I've got the same question to him. Yeah, we've been arguing about this now for the best part of 10 years. In 2005, we were racing at Daytona. In 05, I think, was Marino, myself. I think it was Dan. No, it was Dan in 05. Kev McGarity joined us in 06. It was Dan Weldon and Milka Duno. Obviously, Milka brought the Citgo sponsorship. And so we had a plug lead come off in qualifying. So McNish was there. I don't know what McNish was doing there. He certainly wasn't working. But he said something like, right, son, you've qualified last. How many cars do you think you can pass? And I said, no, I don't know, six or seven or something. He said, right, if you can make it 10, I'll give you $10, right? If you can't, don't make it 10, you owe me 10, right? Okay, fine, good. So we come up to the start, on the inside, at the back of the prototype grid. They've waved the green flag, they've said green, green, green in my ear, whatever. I've pulled out onto the apron. I've gone belting past a load of cars, barged my way through the first corner. End of the first lap, I think I'd passed 12 or something cars. Thought, yes, McNish's money is in my pocket. And just for everybody listening, $10 of McNish's money is at least a million of anybody else's because he is so tight. Anyway, I got a drive-through penalty for jumping the start, crossing, going into the apron, pulling out of line before the start finish line, and a bunch of other stuff. And so I got a drive-through penalty. McNish used that as a technicality and not to pay me my $10. But I never paid him his $10 either. And in fact, we think Julian Jacobi might have the money still. He might have been the depositor of the money, and he was supposed to pay out. And because we can't agree on it, Julian still got it.
Hey, Dario, it could be worse. He could be asking for the interest.
Yeah, exactly. He's not getting that. Trust me. He's not even getting the bloody money.
We just wanted to get that one cleared up. Anyway, so if you're listening, Alan, which you probably are, because you're not very busy these days.
We're all laughing here because he's the busiest man in the world.
Is he? Yeah?
Okay. Oh, God.
Okay, you are busy. But anyway, you're not going to get your money, okay? We must start, Dario, with Formula E, because you are the commentator. And we're all wondering, What do you really think of all this?
I am... Jack's the commentator. Jack's the... I'm the apparent expert.
Oh, okay.
I'm the sort of the colour guy. And Jack does all the really hard work. And I just occasionally put in a comment somewhere and try and sound somewhat intelligent. It is... The way I looked at it, it's the first season. It's very much... They're in the proving process. They're trying to get the infrastructure in order, get the races on the calendar, sort out the technology, and just get a foundation going. And then next year, they're going to start opening up the power units. The manufacturers will probably start getting involved, mm-hmm. and then it can grow. Great racing. It's been absolutely great racing.
Close racing.
Very close racing. Interesting cars to drive. I think they slide around quite a lot with no downforce and mm-hmm. you know the multi-purpose tire. No, I haven't. I was supposed to drive one in a couple of weeks, but it all got messed up with the timing. But you see them slide through the fast corners, and it looks quite interesting. The cars need to be quicker. There's no doubt, and the cars will get quicker in the future. Yeah. It's a difficult one for me, being a, you know, I love the sound of a V12 or, you know, an H16 or you name it, V8, flat six. And so it's a bit difficult for me to sort of to get my head around the fact the cars have this noise that they make. But the way I look at it, at some point the oil's going to run out.
Yeah.
And we better start developing the technology as early as possible. Yep. And if we develop that technology to such a point, hopefully it'll allow us to play with our V12s and H16s and stuff for a longer period. And it's not, in my opinion, it's not replacing F1. It's not replacing IndyCar. It's a completely separate branch. And it was a brave step by the people to go ahead with it. But I will say, Alejandro and the guys that are running the series, I'm impressed with them. Yeah. I thought they've done so far a really strong job.
The thing that impresses me is that every city they go to, they're starting from scratch, having to build a circuit every time, which must be a huge expense for starters. But I mean, obviously, some circuits are better than others naturally with that kind of scenario. But Buenos Aires looked pretty good.
Buenos Aires was good. I'd never been to Argentina, and I'd just been reading a Mike Hawthorne book when I went down there, and he was talking about going down there and all the crazy stuff that happened and cars going in crowds. And I got there and wasn't prepared for the passion of the fans for any type of racing. They're crying out for it. The crowd showed up in massive numbers there, and I was thinking, God, IndyCar, F1, they need to get back here. They need it.
Well, there's talk, isn't there, of Formula One going back to Buenos Aires?
There's talk of Formula One going to pretty much every city in every country in the world.
Exactly. Yeah. But you're right. I mean, it would be certainly something IndyCar should look at.
Yeah, exactly. When
really?
I get back to
Brazil, you know, so why not?
Yeah, when I get back there, that's the first thing I'm going to say to Derek Walker, because it is what a wonderful country and what a passion for racing. Yeah. That really struck me.
I mean, I was supposed to be at the Argentine one. I had to cry off for various reasons at the last moment, but I watched it on TV. I mean, the racing was very good, as has been said, but you could actually, obviously with the silence of the cars, you could actually hear the crowd. And and it was a very lively race, lots of incident, but every time something happened, just to hear the cheers and it was just fantastic. I mean, it was a brilliant atmosphere.
That was clear. And the camera shots, the guys did a great job at showing them.
There was one on the wall one, just I think the penultimate corner, maybe a quick right hander, and it looked sensational.
Yeah, it was a great shot, wasn't it? You could see them sliding, and then the exit wall was the apex of the next corner. It was right at the same point. It was a wonderful set of corners.
Are you sure you're not going to be racing one next year?
Trust me, I'm not allowed. I'm definitely getting the itch to get back in something, and I'm just not allowed. It's just not an option. But the further I'm getting away from that accident, the more I'm getting an itch to drive something.
Where do they draw the line? I mean, I know you're allowed to demonstrate cars, aren't you? How fast are you allowed to demonstrate them?
That's a good question.
No, I just wondered. I just wondered if it had been defined or
nothing competitive. As long as it's not competitive, I think I'm okay. For instance, if I drive up the hill at Goodwood, the clocks can't be on. But I can't race or do anything. That's very clear. I mean, I can go over to Germany and drive on the Autobahn at whatever speed I want. So you know, there's. It's not. I don't think it's about speed. It's about the competitive element.
Well, you've won at the Goodwood Revival, so that's your career topped out anyway, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't get better than that.
That was a high point. Actually, it was a low point the following year with the accident with 4WPD, which was actually one of the concussions that when they were sort of doing the totting up process, they said, well, there was a big one there. Mm. And that was disappointing. I just read a book on it, actually, on the car, on 4WPD, and it talked about the accident. I wish the guy had actually talked to me about the accident. I could have told him some of the stuff that was going on.
Crazy he didn't.
Yeah, it was weird because according to him the car was in rude health and all this sort of stuff, but that clearly wasn't the case, unfortunately.
Certainly wasn't after you'd finished with it.
No, it really wasn't. Is it Sean Lynn that bought it?
Yeah.
God, what a job he's done with it. Just making it perfect. And then obviously Desiree had the accident and a couple of years that car has had more hits than the Beatles, hasn't it?
So, in theory, then, you could become Motorsport's chief track tester and drive any car that we could find for you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an idea, isn't it?
That would be good, wouldn't it? I'm just looking here, and there's a... On the back wall here, there's the artwork of the covers, and the 917K is grabbing my eye.
We don't pay.
We always like to do a bit of business during the podcast. Hey, look, you were last with us in... 2011 seems like yesterday, actually. And what a turmoil you've had since 2011. Amazing. Are you feeling good now? I mean, are you almost back, sort of on top of everything?
Yeah. I mean, my ankle's still a bit average,
really?
But I did go running for the first time the other day. I've been really cautious with it. And eventually I was going to the gym, actually, and I thought, you know what, sod it. I'm going running. If it hurts, it hurts. If something happens, I don't care. I want to be able to go running. And off I went. We did a couple of miles, and it was, it felt good. So apart from that, everything's great.
Good.
So I'm on pretty good form.
That answers a lot of questions.
You know, something that amazes me, when you had the shunt, I mean... It was obviously a bad shunt, and we knew you were hurt. But we'd no idea about how badly you were hurt. Because I think I sent you a text either that night or the next day or something, and you replied, and the reply was perfectly lucid and sort of said, "Yeah, that was a bad one, wasn't it? Whatever."
Mm-hmm.
But then, sort of, you know, a week, 10 days, a fortnight later, I'm hearing from Robin Miller and so on. Boy, you know, this is much more serious than we thought. I mean, I just sort of wondered, was it more serious than you initially thought?
I knew the issues. I actually remember that. I remember texting you. Yeah. And I've got pictures of me sitting in the bed in the hospital with my two dogs, actually, in the hospital room. And I was quite okay to start with.
Yeah.
But then what happened was, actually, quite a while later, my brain, I guess, started to swell up. And that's when it got a bit interesting, and that kind of coincided with a visit to Dr. Olvey and his sort of team there, and that's when they put the, you know, the brakes on and said, no, this isn't going to happen. But I was already worried about my back because I'd broken it before. It was held together with some rods. I'd broken it again in two places, plus some other damage. The ankle was going to be a problem. Essentially, what happened with the ankle, there's a design fault with the car. They attached the master cylinders to the crash structure and not the bulkhead. And when the crash structure did what it's supposed to do, the master cylinders pushed everything back into my leg and shortened it up by a good bit. So the surgeon in Indy did just a mega job. He really did. Dr. Weber, absolute artist. So I was lucky with that. But yeah, I was concerned from a very early stage that this was going to be a problem. But then I thought it was going to be the back, but it turned out it was the head and the concussions, and it's the chance of having another serious concussion. And apparently, the more you have, the less force it takes to cause a bigger problem, and so on and so forth.
Well, that's what happened to Neil Bonnett.
Exactly.
That's exactly what happened to Neil Bonnett.
Yeah.
Anyway. Let's cheer it up. I'd like to ask the question comes from Paul King. I love this one. It says, is it true that you've had the tiles in your bathroom made in the exact same shade of blue as Jim Clark's helmet?
It's not my bathroom.
Hello, whose bathroom is it then?
No, it's actually not my bathroom at all anymore because I sold the house. Ashley and I were restoring an old, silly, big house in Scotland a long time ago, and I took a lot of interest in the bathroom of this one room because it was going to be the Jim Clark room and the garages. And so I went round the tile shops and found the exact blue of Jim's helmet. And so we got the bathroom done in that, and there was, and then as a surprise, I actually got a checkered flag, actually did an artist to draw a checkered flag on the wall and everything in there. It was really, that was cool, but that became the room that all the Jim Clark stuff ended up in, and was a bedroom to start with, but by the end of it there was no space for a bed, so that was the end of that. But no, that's now gone there. Sorry, that was my phone. That's now, I sold that the house. But the next house I get, I'm going to do the same thing.
It's a great story, and thanks, Paul, for the question. It's another Paul, can it be? It is another Paul. This is Paul Gibson. He wants to hear about the story behind the possible F1 test deal that you had with McLaren in 1997 and the Jaguar test deal in 2000. And
Nigel's laughing.
We're supposed to be cheering him up.
Nigel's laughing because he's hoping you're going to tell the absolute truth.
Which one?
The whole story. The
McLaren
whole story.
Or Jag?
Well,
McLaren to start with.
Right, McLaren. You know this. You know the whole story with that one. The McLaren deal came about. It's quite a long story, actually. I'd been obviously driving for Paul Stewart Racing with Jan as a teammate, and Jan had just absolutely blitzed the whole thing. And McLaren had signed him as a test driver. And I keep a lot of things. I keep all the little things that eventually I think that might be interesting. And there was a letter I've got from Ron saying, we signed Jan, you know, we really thought he was exceptional, blah, blah, blah. Sorry, we didn't sign you. I thought, okay, appreciate the letter. Then when I got involved with Mercedes, and I'd been one young driver of the year, the McLaren Autosport young driver, there was a test as part of the prize of that. Well, because I was now a Mercedes driver, it turned into a pretty serious test and not sort of a 5-lap run around Silverstone. So I did the test, and it went quite well, apparently. I was end of 95. So then in start of 97, obviously DTM had finished, and Paul Morgan and Norbert and Carl Hogan all got together and got this deal done for me to go to America. Paul Morgan was really the driving force on that one. And I got this call saying, could you come to McLaren? Ron and Norbert want to see you. So I came back from America, sat down with the two of them, and it was laid out, this long-term deal was laid out where I would race in America in the weekends, come back and drive the McLaren during the week at various tests, because they were testing pretty much Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday most weeks, weren't they? Yeah. I was going to start doing that. I've got the contract at home somewhere. It's massive. I'm trying to think here of what happened with the... But that was the basis of it. And I think they were going to sponsor, or West were going to sponsor the IndyCar or something. There was some way they were going to help fund the whole Hogan thing.
Sounds like a punishing schedule.
It was going to be crazy. And they sent David Brown over. Mm. And David had kind of fallen out of favour, I think, at McLaren, because he told them the car was a load of crap. And David came over at a couple of tests as my babysitter. No, Carl Hogan didn't appreciate that Ron had sent somebody over. And I'm thinking, this guy's one of the best race engineers in the world. Maybe we should, you know, listen to him. But that didn't happen. But anyway, I didn't... The problem with the McLaren deal was they could have got rid of me at any point. Yeah. And I was tied up for a long, long time. And, you know, when I sometimes look back, that was a crossroads, I think. And I could have taken that deal, and who knows what would have happened. They had Mika and David, and they had them for a long time afterwards. Yeah, yeah. So I chose not to take... to do that, much to the... I think surprise and annoyance of Ron and certainly Norbert. Robert and I took a long time to kind of recover from that one. So that was that. And one of the other reasons, you know, Alan had been a McLaren test driver, and I never really felt Alan got a fair deal there at McLaren. And I wasn't sure I wanted to put myself in that position.
Actually, as things turned out, it was a good decision you made, wasn't it?
I think it was.
Don't you think?
I think about who the hell knows what would have happened. And well, I mean, but I trust me, I'm very happy with what I ended up getting to do. And if I'd have made that choice, I might not have got to do any of that stuff.
Absolutely. Well, there'd been no race chance there, because Micah and David, you know, they stayed healthy. They were racing together for a long time. So there was no, it's not like there was suddenly an opening that would have come up.
No, there wasn't. And I think Nick Heidfeld ended up taking that position, and
And that went nowhere for
you. Never got to race in McLaren.
No, so it's, yeah. It was when I look back on it, I think, bloody hell, that was a fairly ballsy move. But I just...
But Ron was stunned when you said no, wasn't he?
If I remember rightly, I think he was, yeah. I don't think I've spoken to Ron since then, actually.
You've not missed much. No.
But the variety of your life in America that you lived since then must be make it worthwhile. All the things you did, the cars you drove, the people you met, places you went to.
Oh, yeah.
And those champ cars of that era as well. I mean,
yeah, absolutely. I got to drive some amazing cars. I mean, not only the current stuff, whether it was the champ cars, the later Indy cars. I think the champ cars were the highlight because they were the big horsepower cars. The later stuff, people say, oh, they were easy to drive. They were never easy to drive because they had less horsepower. You just set them up more aggressively. You would go around Indianapolis, and with the big horsepower cars, you couldn't set them up too oversteery. With the lower horsepower cars, what were originally I hate saying even these letters, but the IRL cars, you just set them up so oversteer that you were just constantly in yaw. And you couldn't drive the other cars like that. You know, the other cars, if they wiggled once and you caught it, great. If they wiggled twice, you knew you were going to hit the wall. But yeah, I got to do sports cars. I was thinking about this a while back. I got to drive and race a lot of different cool cars, from, you know, saloon cars with the DTM, sports cars, you know, the Indy cars. And I might not have been able to do that had I done that deal or the Jag deal.
Yeah, well, I mean, Jaguar probably was one to miss, maybe.
The Jag thing was bizarre, and it came from a conversation between Julian Jacoby and myself, and it was something along the lines of, you know, I'd like to have a wee go. I'm paraphrasing here, and Jackie said, I'll see what I can do. So I went to Dearborn, to Ford. I sat with the guys there, and it got quite complicated pretty quickly. And it wasn't a case of, okay, go and have a test in our car, see if you like it. It was, right, here's a contract. And if it goes well, we've already got the contract in the briefcase, so to speak. If it doesn't, then we'll give it a miss. And Barry Green was good enough to release me to do the test, but he then said, if you don't end up doing the F1 thing, I want a deal. So that, which I was fine with because I loved racing there, so I signed a deal there as well. And I ended up, I remember going to Silverstone. I went over in Concord to do a seat fit. They were clearly spending the money in the wrong ways. Old Jag. It still amazes me that Red Bull came out of that.
Yeah, yeah.
Or that Stewart Grand Prix became that.
Yeah.
So I go over to the seat, come back, and when I went over there, it wasn't a very good atmosphere straight away. I could tell I wasn't exactly wanted, I would say. And the mechanics were telling me what the engineers were doing wrong with the cars, and it was kind of one of those things. Anyway, I came back to the test. I would do these sort of press gatherings, and my lawyer at the time, Peter Goodman, had to sit next to me, tell me what questions I could answer. I'm thinking, this is too bloody complicated. I just want to drive the car. So I get in the car, and I was, from my side, I was struggling because I'd had that accident at Homestead where I'd broken my pelvis. I'd given myself a proper knock on the head, which I really think took me 2 years to get over that concussion. And so I was not in good form anyway. I had a ruptured disc in my neck, which is your first time in a Formula One car in quite a while. It's not the best thing, maybe. So I was not in the best of form. Anyway, went out first day, not too bad. Come in the next morning, I've got a different car already because I think one of them suspension broke and it crashed on the hang straight, blah, blah, blah. And who the hell knows what spec it was, whatever, but I was way off the pace. And, you know, maybe put some of that down to, if I was doing long runs, I'd put some of it down to my, you know, my physical fitness, my concussion or whatever. But I was still back in America, but a month later I broke the lap record at Road America in qualifying. So I was still able to make a car go quick over one lap. But I don't know why. I don't know what spec the car was. I don't know why it was sort of the test happened the way it did, but it was clear that I was not wanted. And
did you feel that from the outset, that the everything was in place for it not to work out?
Yeah. And I was pretty clear that I didn't want to be part of it. But it put, I think that test put paid to any chance I had of ever doing anything in Formula One ever again, because I was so far off. And as I say, you know, I was still, even with the mental and the physical stuff going on from that accident, I was still able to put, you know, fling a car around for one lap. But so.
Sounds depressing, actually.
It was absolutely not a happy ship. Jesus, no. You know, long before you went there.
No, absolutely. And Bobby Rahal, when he went there, he then came out and said, oh, there was some weird stuff going on at that test and stuff. And so I remember I was in New York. I was driving, getting driven along somewhere, and the phone rang, and it was Neil Wrestler saying, we've decided we're not going to do it. And I said, oh, thank God, because I really don't want to do it either. And and that was very much the end of that. So that was the Jag deal.
Bobby's the next lunch with in the magazine, actually. So Simon hasn't filed a copy yet. I'm interested to see what his take is now, all these years later, on the whole Jaguar thing, and you know, what he can say about it, really.
Hopefully it's as good as lunch with AJ.
That's good, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, I love AJ. Yeah. It's when the Mario Andretti thing, when Simon said, oh, I had burgers too with Andretti. Yeah. Even before I'd read the next line, I thought, oh, no. Simon's not going to get to Texas alive.
But the curious thing is, when you speak to either of them, they can't actually, the problem they have, they can't trace it back to any one thing. It's just a kind of general, well, we just don't get on. Well, why don't you? Well, but you never get a firm. Can you? Do you know of anything?
No. You were in that. I mean, you went to that dinner last year, and it's the same with Bobby Unser and Mario to a degree. It's the same with any of those guys from that era. Mm. That they all, I think the competition was so intense. Mm. And
yeah. Parnelli, same thing. Yeah,
they all, top dog. I think. Yeah,
they still hold on to. I don't know if they're grudges, but they've still got that competitive element with each other. I remember, Gurney sat at a dinner that Jim Hall, the RRDC, do that dinner at Long Beach every year. That Bobby Rahal does a great job with, and Jim Hall was sort of giving some. He was the honoree one year, and he was telling a story, and Gurney waves me over, and he says, "Didn't happen that way." I was like, really? He's like, yeah, no, that wasn't, that's his version of the truth.
When you were listing some of the great stuff you've done in the States, you omitted to mention the word NASCAR. Do you have any regrets about your flirtation with that?
I mean, you said great stuff.
The stuff you listed was great, but you didn't mention NASCAR. I just wondered, any regrets at all?
No regrets. I mean, I've been told, oh, well, you could have won another 500 or another championship. And the way I look at it, in 2008, you probably weren't going to beat Scott Dixon anyway. If I was an IndyCar, I probably, you know, Dixon was on a charge that year and ultimately I think would have beaten anybody to that championship and the 500. No, because I learned a hell of a lot at NASCAR. You know, there's nothing like going from winning the championship in IndyCar in the 500 to just getting kicked in the guts every weekend and not having a clue what you're doing and just having to sort of dig unbelievably deeply to try and finish in the top 25 in a race. And so I really learned a lot, and it allowed me, the way it worked out, I took a year out essentially and got to get into the Target team. That would not have happened had I stayed in IndyCar. It was a weird time, but I did some decent performances, I think, in the Nationwide car, which I got a hell of a lot of satisfaction out of. But I wouldn't be rushing, even if I was fit. I wouldn't do that again. It was just so different, and to try and... It would be like somebody who's never... It'd be like Jimmy Johnson saying, right, I'm going to go race single-seaters. I'm going to F1. Yeah, not having not driven. Mm. And that's kind of what I tried to do, and it was probably ill-advised. And that would have been trying to win races in a Marussia, really, because at that point, the Ganassi cars were not very good.
Where was it? I remember you telling me... At the time, it was just after you dropped, or you just got out of NASCAR and you were relieved. But you were just talking about, you know, you have no idea what these things are like. And there was, I can't remember, it was, might have been Alcard, I don't think it was, can't have been Alcard. Somewhere, anyway, you had tested a sports car, and there was a particular corner that was just about flat. And it was it second gear in the stock car?
You're absolutely
car?
Right, great memory. Where
was it?
It was Road Atlanta.
It was? Okay.
And I'd gone there to test, not even the cup car, the Nationwide car. And we'd run round all day. And the first corner was brake, not hard, but you know, fairly gentle brake, down two gears, up the hill. I'll never forget that test, because at the end of the day, he pulled out a car and goes, now try this one. And it was a second and a half quicker than the other car, because the body was a little different. I was like, oh, okay. But anyway, I went there, would have been 3 months later, with Duncan Dayton, asked me to come and drive with Scott Sharp and David Brabham, and it was flat in sixth gear in the qualifying lap. Absolutely on the boards. A bit of a culture shock after driving the old NASCAR for a year, I'll tell you. Yeah.
Okay, we must take some more questions from our loyal readers and listeners, and this one comes from Glenn Alcock, and he wants to know, Dario, if you could have driven in any era, what would it be, and what type of racing would you have enjoyed the most? So you could pick from the beginning of time.
I think the 30s would have been pretty interesting.
Sure would.
I'm not sure I would have wanted to drive for the guy that was paying the bills. But
well, you fancy an auto union with a cloth helmet.
I was thinking more of the front engine stuff with Mercedes, but still ultimately, yeah. I'd love to have had a go. The 60s,
yeah,
you know, that I've funny enough, I just got all a bunch of motorsports from 61 through to 89. I started and I read the whole thing from 65 already, was the first year I picked. I would have loved to have raced in the 60s, but I'm not sure I would have survived, to be honest.
Well, plenty didn't.
No, yeah,
no.
What is it? I mean, what is the appeal of it? Because so many people do talk about that era, you know, about it, the quality of the racing, the atmosphere, everything. But there's something about it. What is it? The cars were very pretty, weren't they? Nice looking cars.
I think the cars were. Yeah, they were very pretty. I mean, you read the magazine, and it was a different time. You know, the cars were getting the car to the end of a race was a major achievement. Yeah. The racing probably wasn't that great. It was more about a lot of times you weren't racing the other guy, you were racing the track and the car.
Yeah.
You know, keeping the car together. It would have just, I think, maybe it's a romantic thing, but just to go back and to experience that, I think would have been wonderful. To drive.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promoting for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Of all those different cars on a weekend. And
that was a big thing, wasn't it? So like seeing Jimmy Clark in a Cortina and in a Grand Prix car and possibly even in a sports car.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine, you know, that'd be like seeing Alonso driving three races on a weekend when he went to a Grand Prix.
Well, no, absolutely. And I can remember days like that with Jimmy. You know, I can remember...
Sure.
I can remember Jimmy doing a national meeting at Alton Park.
Is that right?
Yeah, in 1964. And he was reigning world champion. It was I mean, it was just a national meeting. Mm. It was in, I think it was in April, it was just before I went back to school. Anyway, I was there. And Jimmy should have given the Lotus 30 its debut, and it wasn't ready. And there was a guy called George Pitt at the time who raced a Lotus, still racing a Lotus 19. And he said to Jimmy, do you want to? And Jimmy said, yeah, okay.
You're kidding?
No. And Jimmy drove the Lotus 19, of course, won the race. And he drove an Elan in another race that day, yeah. And the Cortina.
Fantastic.
And that was a national meeting at Alton Park in April. And he was world champion at the time.
Derry, yeah. you get the sports heritage, you understand it, you're passionate about it. When you've been talking to your contemporary racers, have you found many others who've got the same kind of interest in history? If you just start discussing Lotus 38, they look at you blankly.
Yeah, there's not. I think maybe there's not that many. Marino's the same. I mean, he's just as bad as me. Yeah. I'm trying to think through the grid. I think Marco's getting more into it. I think Marco's getting more into his Nonno's legacy, to Mario's legacy, and looking into that. And he's getting a bit more excited about that whole thing, which is great. And I'm not sure. I mean, James Hinchcliffe's a massive Greg Moore fan, which I think is great, and he's sort of excited by that.
They need to come to Goodwood and see what it's all about.
One of the interesting things I find talking to racing drivers is a lot of the guys aren't interested in road cars at all. You know, it's just that all they're focused on is the racing side, and road cars don't really mean much to them. You're not the same, are you? You're interested in the road stuff as well.
Yeah, I love road cars. Actually, Graham Rahal, I think, has got quite a good sense of the history of the sport. Yeah, I love road cars. I love cars of any description, to be quite honest. And I love all different kinds of road cars. And I think, unfortunately for Marino, his son Luca is taking over that same thing. He is anything. He's fascinated by anything that's got an engine, motorbikes, cars, helicopters.
And do you still ride bikes?
Motorbikes.
Yeah.
I've got nothing sort of
exciting.
Quick.
Right.
I've still got an MV Agusta in kit form from the accident. But I've got some big old cruisers. I'm thinking about something for London, maybe like a Triumph Scrambler that I can customize, or a Ducati or something. I'm thinking about that just now. And at this point, my mother and my insurance broker have just fallen over if they're listening to this.
Actually, that answers one of our questions. And another one is, you've gone back to live in Scotland.
I have.
Why?
Because I love it, and it's home.
That's a good answer.
Yeah, it's for 14 years, I think, I lived in the States, maybe longer.
Yeah.
And I had the most wonderful time. I lived in the most wonderful place. In Nashville was stunning, where I lived, and had a great time. But I was always homesick.
Really?
Yeah.
Were you?
Yeah.
Is that right? Always?
Always homesick.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? I never knew that.
And up until about 2007, I didn't even have any cars over there or anything. I didn't sort of... And then I started to sort of get one or two cars over there that I could play around with. But I'd kept a big chunk of my life in Scotland. And so the fact that I can now come home is fantastic. I'm spending as much time in America. No, not quite as much time. But I'm on a planes a lot.
Yeah.
I'm traveling a lot now, back to the IndyCar races, the Formula E stuff, and various other stuff that I've got going on. Stuff I'm doing with Honda, that kind of stuff. So I'm flying back and forwards a lot, but really enjoying being back in Scotland and down here in London, and being able to go and do road trips in Europe and stuff like that.
Yeah.
How many races will you go to with Ganassi this year, do you think?
We're talking about that right now. At least 10. Okay. At least 10, maybe 16. We're sort of trying to figure that out just now.
Are there any adventures you've got in mind that you want to do? You know, any trips or things you always fancy having a go at?
We talked about that, didn't we? We talked about going down to down to Sicily, and I still fancy doing that. I want to get into the Alps and head east a bit from there as well, see some of the great roads. But the Sicily thing, you know, I read the BRDC did a book. I think it was when Jenks died. It was a sort of a thing of his columns. No. It was the best of his columns, basically. And that really got me in the mood to go and do all these crazy road trips. And now having, you know, these motorsport magazines to read over however many years, it's sort of really getting me in the mood again to go and do that.
Jenks drove to the Targa in 1965, I think.
In
the land. Can you believe?
I just read that.
Talk about an act of faith. I mean, I had three Elans and I adored them, but for long journeys, you know, it was not a... And he went in a Europa. The original... You remember the original Renault-engined Europa?
Oh, my God.
With windows that didn't open. Yeah?
Can you imagine the heat?
Yes. It had Colin Chapman air conditioning. That was all it had.
That trip when he did that in the Lotus was incredible. He talks about all the spares he had in the back and nobody could believe it actually got there. And what was it the factory said to him? If you get to Sicily, don't worry, we've got the race team mechanics will put the thing back together for you.
If you get there.
Yeah, if you get there.
If you see them.
Brilliant. I think you've got to repeat this journey, haven't you? You've got to do it.
Oh, yeah.
You've got to do it.
The other adventure we want to do is when Border Reavers bought the D-Type, he had to get it to Full Sutton, and something happened to the truck, so they basically pulled the D-Type off the back of the truck not far from Duns or from Churnside, and he drove it in the snow to Full Sutton. And I quite fancy recreating that journey.
You could do it this week, the way things are.
I was going to say, I'm not sure we'd do it in the snow this time. I think the owner might be a little perturbed, but that'd be fun.
Well, we're on the subject of the Scots. Tony Guerin points out, actually, that you, McNish, Coulthard, all retired. Who's coming from Scotland in the future?
Yeah, that was a tough one, wasn't it? I mean, obviously, DC had retired, Alan, just right after me. That came as a bit of a shock to me, I must admit.
Really? You thought he'd keep going for a bit?
Yeah, he seemed to still have the fire, which just shows how good he is at hiding it. You know,
he's a bugger for that. Because I did a road trip with him after the Austin sports car race, and he'd won the race, and he was clearly on the way to the championship. And the retirement thing on our trip was in the air, and I was like, I'll ask him about it once we get warmed up and see. You know. And he was very cagey about it. And he said afterwards that weekend was the time when it started to really be something he's seriously thinking about. Up until then, he hadn't.
But I don't think I did him any favours with my little exhibition in Houston.
Your name did come up. Yeah.
I think it got him thinking. what was the question?
Well, no, Tony Guerin is saying...
Who's coming from?
Yeah, who's coming from Scotland? Because, you know, looking back over the years, we've had great Scots, haven't we?
Well, I think David Leslie, father and son, should get a lot of that credit.
Yeah.
Because of the... You know, we had... Obviously, Jim, Jackie, Jerry Birrell, and then there was some guys that were fairly good, and then David Leslie came along with a lot of talent and no money, and then Bert McNish, Duncan Coulthard, my dad, they were the guys that really were taking the big risks to help their sons, and Alan came along in 87 with. Into cars. I mean, obviously started carts a lot earlier than that, but Alan, then David came along 2 years later. I came along 2 years later after that. Ryan came along, DL. There's a bunch of the guys, Andrew Kirkcaldy, Marino came along. And then more recently, Paul. The rest are clearly, you know, he did. If ever there's proof that talent doesn't count for that much in F1, he's a good example, as is Jean-Éric Vergne, actually. Yeah. It's not just limited to British drivers.
No, sure.
You know, as I said. And so right now, Ryan's doing a good job in America. Marino, when he can get in a car, is doing a great job. Obviously, he won Sebring last year.
Yep.
Paul is now back in DTM, and hopefully with the Mercedes guys, have got their stuff together this year and they can make a run at the championship. But there's a bunch of enthusiasts in Scotland who are really keen to keep
the tradition,
keep the factory going, keep the young drivers coming up.
Good.
And so we're working quite hard on that just now. Well, obviously, we've got Kieran Haggerty, who Simon saw at the festival, and you know, does a great job. He's at the very early stages, but hopefully we can help him get up the ladder. We were lucky. We had obviously Jackie and the Staircase of Talent, and you know, with Paul Stewart Racing, and that was, for me, that was a lifeline.
It's harder now, isn't it, to come up?
I don't know. I mean, it was pretty bloody hard then, I must admit. When you've got no money, it's always hard.
Yeah.
But
at least there were opportunities in when you were coming up. I know it wasn't, I'm not saying it was easy, of course it wasn't, but there seemed to be so few opportunities, certainly in this country, and the single-seater ladder's so fragmented, and you know, you've got Racing Steps are doing great things. You know, Red Bull have put a lot in over the years, but that's about it, really. There's not many.
I'm trying to think, yeah, where you can go if you don't have a budget. And I'm, you know, coming up a blank here.
Play tennis, I suppose.
Yeah. Actually, Andy was winning when I left to come here. He's doing a hell of a good job. You're right. What do you do?
I mean, just looking at the numbers, I mean, as we stand at the moment for 2015, there are 18 Formula One cars on the grid. Well, just below that, you've got 22, 23 Formula Renault 3.5 cars. You've got 26 GP2 cars. You've got 27 GP3 cars. You can have 40, 45 FIA F3 cars. I mean, there's an awful lot of people there chasing. I mean, there's only 1-2% of them have got any chance at all. And you know, Red Bull owns 4 of the F1 cars.
Yeah.
Yeah. The numerically, the chances are stacked against everybody, pretty much.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, obviously, if you decide, as I did back in the day, that okay, IndyCar is the way to go, that opens up a bit more. Or you can go the sports car route, and that opens up a wee bit more too. But ultimately, there's not the turnover of drivers at the top end that there used to be either. Because it's
safer and careers last longer and
touch wood. It's not, you don't get guys like Jackie retiring at the absolute top of their game at 33. Yeah. That doesn't happen. So there's a traffic jam at the top, and I don't know how to fix it. And even before that traffic jam, to find the money to fund is very, very difficult. So I'm glad and I'm lucky, I think, and fortunate, if that's the word, that I was involved in the period that I was.
Got a question from Croatia. Comes from Davor Stimac, and he wants to know, do you think that the new aero packages that are being developed for IndyCar will attract any of the F1 design guys to go over and tackle that?
I kept asking Adrian Newey every time I see him at Goodwood or at some other thing. I'm like, come on, Adrian, look, just design a body kit. Come on. Come on, it'll be fun. He never took me up on it. No, I don't think there's the money there, because they've got to sell them for a certain amount. I think it's quite an open set of rules. I think it's good. I don't know what they look like. I haven't seen either. I certainly wouldn't have seen the Honda one, and I haven't been testing with the team when the Chevy guys have been running it. But we need to be careful there with those body kits, that, you know, they don't sort of start taking backward steps with sort of taking downforce away again or whatever, because there was a reason for doing them, and that was to increase performance.
Yeah.
And so let's let that increase performance run, I think, as well, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that there is a need also for the cars to look different. And that was what I thought at Indy last year. It's the, you know, to have, all right, paint schemes, you know, have an effect on you know, what you're seeing, but fundamentally you're looking at 33 identical cars. So I mean, from that point of view, I think it's needed.
Totally agree with you, Nigel. The only problem, we were talking about this the other day, if you took the F1 grid and painted them all white,
same thing.
You definitely wouldn't know, would you?
I think they're, you know, with all the wind tunnels and the CFD now and everything, they're getting so close to the, you know, that perfect point that they might end up just looking the same, and hopefully it'll allow them to run quicker. There's certainly I would imagine there's going to be a lot more downforce for some of the tracks. Hopefully they'll run quicker at Indianapolis. And I tell you one thing, though, I think it's going to be a lot more physical for the drivers, because the G-forces are going to be even bigger. They're already big, and there's no power steering in those cars, and they're heavy. I spoke to Daniel Abt after he tested at Barber, and he'd driven, you know, what, a couple of years in GP2? And he was just blown away by the physical effort of driving that thing.
And GP2 cars aren't, I mean, they're not, you know, they're physical. I mean, they've got no power-assisted steering or anything. I mean, they're big brutes of cars as well.
Yeah, and he said, that wasn't even close to the IndyCar.
Why is it just on cost grounds that it's not allowed? Or, I mean, why wouldn't it be otherwise? I mean, it just,
I don't know. We've had this discussion for 10 years plus. You know, drivers are, the steering is so heavy that drivers are injuring themselves. And just with the force, and especially as when the forces spike in a dip or a compression or something, and there's been nothing done about it. So I don't know if it's cost. I doubtful. It's not that expensive to put a set of to put a power steering system in a car. Maybe it just can't be put in the car. We asked that it be designed into this latest Dallara, and it wasn't.
Actually, Scott Cleary has a question. It's very simple, straightforward. He says, "What would you do to get IndyCar back to its absolute best? If you were in charge right now, what would you do?"
That is such a difficult question, because there's always the unintended consequences of your actions. So
it's a gut feeling, though.
The on-track product's great. I would definitely give the cars more horsepower again.
More speed.
The downside with that, though, is as soon as you start giving them more horsepower, it shortens up the straights, and you're not going to get as much overtaking because you're on the straight for less time. You've got less time to set up a pass.
Yeah. People like Parnelli and Bobby Unser and so on are always saying, yeah, they should definitely do that, more horsepower, but they should also take downforce away.
Which is the...
Because Parnelli was saying last year, it was at its best when they were bullet quick in a straight line, and you simply could not think about, taking the turns flat. So there had to be a lift. And they said that way you got overtaking.
Yeah.
And it was a matter of who lifted for how long. And
there's also safety consideration here, isn't there?
No, I think nowadays there's always safety consideration, isn't there? That's always a big part of it, whereas before it wasn't so much, I would say. Before, being decades before.
Yeah.
The downforce thing is, especially with this new car, we've just talked about the body kits, which is going the opposite way. But I think come Indy, hopefully they'll be able to make these things so slippery that they'll be right on the edge again. Yeah, I do agree. Take some downforce away. But then you're talking Indianapolis. What about the road courses and the short ovals?
Yeah.
Taking downforce away is not the answer there, I would say, because I drove the Champ car with the Speedway wings on those, I think it was 2001 and 2. And because they had limited downforce, if you were leading, you had clear air, great. As soon as you got behind, you could be running, literally a second a lap quicker around a short oval. And you get behind the guy and you couldn't get close because your car was so reliant on any fraction of downforce. So you have to be careful of that. I think with the downforce, those guys had zero downforce. Any car in the last sort of 20, 30 years has had, some. So I don't know how far back, when you say take all the downforce away, you'd have to take everything away to do that. One thing the fans love it. As a driver, I didn't like about this new car at Indianapolis. It provides great racing. But if you're able to run 227 miles an hour and the guy... your racing can run only 225 at the front, he just can sit behind you. The car creates such a hole in the air that you cannot get away. You just, no matter how quickly you run, you just can't. There's no payoff for being the quickest. You're setting yourself up for that last lap of the race. Yeah.
Dario, whenever we invite people to send in questions, somebody always mentions Juan Pablo Montoya. I don't know why, but they do. Now, this is very good news for Nigel Roebuck, because Nigel is a huge fan of Juan Pablo. Anyway, Chris B wants to know, what did you think of Montoya's forays in America. I mean, bear in mind, okay, you know, he had a pretty good time in Formula One.
I mean, I go back years, 20 years plus with Monty. You know, he drove my Vauxhall Lotus car.
In fact, he
crashed it when the brake pedal fell off. The brake pedal literally fell off the car, and he had a huge accident, and I thought he'd crashed it and had a little word with him. We were teammates in the DTM for a race when we smashed doors for a lap at Silverstone. He showed up in America, and you know, he was mighty. He really was. He was, you know, he was in the best team at the time and everything, but he was mighty.
Yeah.
And he went away to F1, and I almost, there was being super critical. There was a lot of unfilled potential there. He was that good. Went back to America, did the NASCAR thing, and that was just never. The cars, as I said, when I drove them, the cars were never that good. And when the cars were never as good as they needed to be. I don't think Monty put the work in.
Yeah.
I don't think he had the experience to know what to do either. So that was ultimately a very. For him and for Chip was just it was a letdown.
You see, he kept insisting. I used to say to him, "This cannot, someone with your mentality, this cannot be satisfying." And he was, "No, I love it, NASCAR, I think it's great." I thought, I really struggling to believe you.
I read that when you would ask him that question, and he would say, "Then we've discussed it too, Nigel." And I would think it can't be. And I was part of that team for a while. And I tell you, it wasn't bloody fun for me. And, you know, was it the fact he could do what he liked outside the car? You know, he could go and he didn't have to train and he'd spend time flying his airplanes or riding his bikes. Whatever. I don't know if that was the reason. But when he came back to IndyCar last year, I thought, all right, okay, here we go. This is going to be interesting. And he was definitely out of shape to start with. And he's still, you know, he's not Scott Dixon, Tony Kanaan fit. But he's as strong as a bull. He's as stubborn as a bull too. But he, at the start, he looked like he was struggling. He really, the early tests, I said to him, it was like winding him up. I said, it's the first time I've seen you not look like you didn't know what you were doing. And he got really angry, which was the idea. But he quickly came back to looking like the old Montoya. And as the season went on, only became more so. And in my opinion, he's going to be one of the guys you're going to have to go through to win the championship this year.
Really?
Yeah. And I think he's got his excitement for racing back. And like you said, he kept saying that he was loving it. I said I was loving it too when I was doing it. Yeah. But I think he's got his passion for racing back.
You can see he's got another 500 in him, definitely. Do you think he's got a championship in him in terms of week in, week out?
Yes and yes. I think he's got one more championship in him, and he's definitely got at least one 500 in him. He did it the last 75% of the season impressed me a lot, and I'm quite critical, and I was very impressed with what he did.
I have to say, I had the privilege of working with him for 2 or 3 years as he was coming up the European ladder, and he was great fun, and he's actually one of the most naturally gifted young drivers I've ever worked with, without question. I mean a complete fruitcake at times, but in a good way.
Yeah.
In a good way.
There's never been a period, apart from maybe those 2 years at Ganassi, where he got his experience level, his desire, and everything lined up at the same point. Do you know what I mean? I think now he might have that, and if he does. Yeah, I think that natural talent was always there, but the desire sometimes was maybe not there, or,
I remember there was the F3000 street race in Helsinki in 97. I mean, he was way quicker than everybody immediately, and everyone else kind of gradually got to the kind of level he'd set on his first or second flying lap. And then in the race, he just got away, and the team were putting out boards saying, bloody well, slow down, you idiot. And eventually, of course, he stuck it in the wall. And as far as I know, Helmut Marko is still to this day furious about it.
No, somebody doing that in Helsinki. I might have done that two years in a row in the DTM car. Did exactly the same thing.
Probably not while your team was telling you to slow down because you were leading by 35 seconds and you didn't need to go any faster.
Maybe. I'd like to come from the back of the grid and done it. Yeah, anyway. No, the other thing with Monty, he's getting smarter. He is getting... He's got that experience now, and his, you watch him in the longer races, how his brain works now, and you go, okay. So, yeah, he'll be a handful.
He had his problems with Ron as well, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. What's it they say? He fell off his tennis racket.
or he's playing tennis on a motocross bike. It was one of the two things.
Yeah,
I can't remember which.
I can't imagine
two more different people, actually. But anyway.
Apparently they get on. He was at the Grand Prix in Austin, and they had a great chat. And
But they used to play golf. But what he could never understand was that when he'd play golf, when he was his great, you know, great mate, and then next day in the factory, you know, Ron would just walk straight past him, and he was back to being an employee.
All is forgiven, like Fernando and Ron.
Were they playing golf on motocross bikes?
Let's take one last question from Anthony Jenkins, and it's, Dario, can you tell him what the biggest differences are between racing in America and racing in Europe? Because I think a lot of people think, well, okay, it's just you go racing, whether it's Africa, Australia. What are the fundamental differences?
There's an attitude difference. I don't know. To say less bullshit would be too simplified, I think. You know, people see over there the drivers getting on and think, oh, yeah, they're just there having a good time. The competition level is every bit, at the IndyCar level, is every bit as tough as in Europe. You've all got the same stuff. You don't have the advantage of having, you know, a Mercedes engine last year or any of that stuff. So you've got to find it in other ways. And the competition level's high, but the drivers seem to maybe get on a bit better. And maybe that's because of the danger level of the ovals. I don't
you reckon?
Yeah, I think that could. That plays a fact in a lot of things that happen, I think, in America with the way people go racing. But... yeah, apart from that, it's racing as usual, I would say. There's a different feel to it.
But there's a different feel, too, to the kind of... the teams, the drivers, seem closer to the fans than they do. There doesn't seem to be this kind of, we're not really interested in you lot out there feeling.
Definitely closer. Well, it's an open paddock. With IndyCar, it's an open paddock.
Makes a big difference.
So you are there and...
Yeah.
So if to come to America as a fan, you definitely get a much closer view of things, and which I think is a huge positive.
You know, I can remember the first time I went to Indy. I can remember being absolutely knocked sideways by that, because that was, when was that, 81? But by then, Formula One had starting to become rarefied, and you couldn't buy a paddock pass or anything like that. It absolutely blew me away that at the Indy 500. Which, without any question, was then far and away the biggest race on earth. And the fans could get access. It amazed me.
Yeah, it's a bit busy on race morning, isn't
it? Yeah, it is. It is. But
you know, I've really appreciated that last year. You know, doing my job for Ganassi and not being so caught up in it. And you know, when I raced, I was fully focused on what was going on, and so I was rushing from one meeting to another, or and everything else was a distraction. And so last year I was able to sort of sit back a bit and spend a bit more time talking to the fans and you know, watch that whole thing, especially at Indy. And it's amazing to see the how close the fans can get to everything. And
I was struck by that. I went to the Daytona 24 Hours for the first time in 2014, and I walked onto the grid with my cameras and stuff to take some pictures, but I couldn't actually get my camera up because there are tens of thousands of fans, just ordinary paying punters, on the grid, which is brilliant.
Yeah, the start of Daytona, the mechanics are always in a pure panic that somebody's going to knock the wing. Same at Indy.
No, absolutely, yeah.
You know, if you've got a certain pass at Indy, you can get on the grid there, and it is so busy.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting, you know, getting ready to get in the car, and the mechanics are all stationed on the four corners of the car to keep people away from all the sensitive areas. Somebody knocks a wing, you know, trust me. Can
God, wouldn't you just hate to be the person who did that?
That wouldn't be good, yeah.
Okay, we're running out of time. Thank you very much. It's great to see you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
try and do a deal with our editor here, because I think you should do some regular stuff in the magazine. I mean, all this free time, man.
He's on airplanes all year.
I tell you what, we'll give you an extra $10 so that you can forget about it. You'll never get it from McNish.
No, I'm never getting that money. That money's never coming back, is it?
Actually, last thing, have you driven a Roadster? Because if you have, I don't think you've ever...
No, I haven't yet.
I mean...
I'm gonna.
Yeah, I mean, I was gonna say, I look forward to
I'm definitely
what you have
to
say about it afterwards.
That sounds like a cover story for the October issue to me.
Back to back, that and the 38-1.
Whoa.
There you go.
You're definitely doing that.
I believe so. Mm. That would be cool.
Great. Okay, thanks so much, Dario Franchitti. Great way to start the year, no? First podcast of the year. Well, we have to try and make it as good as this every month, won't we, Ed Foster?
No pressure, Ed.
Okay. Thank you very much for joining us, everybody. It's great to have you with us, and thanks for your support. Just to let you know that next month, Mark Blundell will be with us. Yes. Oh, I'm so glad this isn't television.
That'll be great. I mean, the amount of stuff that Mark has driven. Yeah. I'm going to send in questions for that.
Do that. Does he owe you any money?
Marky does not owe me any money. I mean, he talk about a varied career.
Yeah.
Can't wait for that one.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, send in a question. That'd be great. The more the merrier. Anyway, Mark Blundell will be here in next month. So you haven't got long to wait, actually, because he's coming in a couple of weeks' time. So we look forward to that. And do join us for that, please. So it's goodbye from us, from Nigel Roebuck, from Simon Aaron, from our editor Damien, from Ed, who puts the show together, from Alan, who records it, and from Dario Franchitti. Bye-bye. See you next time.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.